Welcome to the podcast, Deconstructing Alpha, where we have timely and unscripted conversations with who I believe to be some of the best investment managers in the world. I am your host, Jeremy Van Arkel. I'm a partner with Frontier Asset Management, and I am joined today by Shannon Carroll, who emanates from our global headquarters of world domination in Sheridan, Wyoming. And today, for a first time for this podcast, we are really upping our game and becoming professional. And we are coming to you live from the GoBYO studios, also in Sheridan, Wyoming. So, Shannon, how are you today?
I'm doing great today, Jeremy. How are you?
I'm pretty good. I'm really excited about recording another podcast. I'm completely surprised and stunned at the people that have agreed to be interviewed by me. Is that a little bit surprising to you?
No, not at all, Jeremy.
you've just figured everybody would be very interested in being on this this podcast about esoteric investment subjects, huh?
Exactly. Who wouldn't want to talk to you?
Who wouldn't want to do that? All right. So Shannon, you got between now and the last podcast, you got some pretty good news.
I did. Yes. The new account service manager. So
you got promoted?
I did. Yep.
Are you a boss?
I am a boss. I feel pretty lucky and blessed to be with Frontier.
Welcome to the world of being a boss. You have to be bossy now. So anyway, thanks for joining us on the call. And as usual, I look forward to summarizing this call with you, as well as staying till the end of the call to cover some compliance notes. And of course, our color and take on this. And if you've listened to these podcasts before, you know, these are going to be unscripted and hopefully very timely interviews with brilliant investment managers. I'm very fortunate to be able to interview these people just through my position here at Frontier. We invest in a lot of other investment management companies, and maybe I've strong-armed them into being a victim on my show here and being interviewed. But everybody's been extremely gracious so far, but Shannon is going to listen in as well. She's going to take some notes, and she's going to help me at the end summarize and make sure we don't go down rabbit holes and get into too many complicated subjects. And Shannon's such a bright, bubbly personality that she's going to add some color here as well. So I'm pretty excited about the interview today. Shannon, I don't know if you know this, but we're going to interview Rob Almeida, and he is the chief global strategist for MFS. Right. So have you heard of MFS funds?
I have. Yes.
Yeah. So they're kind of a pretty big firm, and I'm kind of excited about this because, you know, it's cool to talk to a global strategist because we've talked so far with specific fund managers, but global strategists have a more sort of holistic view upon the whole world and interest rates in the economy and changes, you know, changes that are occurring across the globe, whereas portfolio managers are specific to separate strategies in small parts of the world. So in that respect, Rob's role is pretty similar to mine, I think, but there's so we should have a fun conversation, but there's one slight difference. So, you know, Frontier Asset Management, while we're big in our channel and we're very well known, a lot of listeners in the outside world might not know who Frontier Asset Management is, but they probably certainly know who MFS funds are because MFS manages approximately $500 billion in AUM. So that's a little bit more than Frontier Asset Management.
Yeah, just a little.
Just a little. We're getting there. So I would like to say a word about MFS. You know, I review and have reviewed mutual funds and investment management strategies for decades. And, you know, each firm has its unique attributes. And across time and across many different portfolios and mutual funds and offerings, MFS has been a really solid firm. You know, there's few firms that sort of rise. You know, there's lots of different specialty strategies available in the mutual fund space or investment management space, but there's few funds that have multiple strategies that really are as big as MFS that really tend to do an excellent job across all strategies. And so I think MFS is one of those quality firms where they're really doing something special to maintain quality across multiple strategies. And I'm kind of excited about this call because I want to make sure I get to that. That's that deconstructing alpha. How has MFS been so good for so long with so many different strategies? But I also fear, or I'm looking forward to one or the other, having a spirited macro conversation, because I'm sure Rob is concerned about the same things I'm concerned about. So, we have the same job. He's probably got a pretty bigger perspective than me. I can't wait to talk more with him. So I guess without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, Rob Almeida, Global Investment Strategist and Portfolio Manager for MFS Mutual Funds. So, Rob, welcome to the podcast, Deconstructing Alpha. I'm so glad you joined us here today. It's a beautiful Friday here in Atlanta. Whereabouts are you located?
I was just going to say, it's a beautiful Friday here as well. I am in the Boston area, about 30 miles north. The Cape you never heard of, Cape Ann, not Cape Cod. But thank you for having me.
Yeah, is that sort of near 30 miles north of Boston, did you say?
Correct.
Yeah. So is that near Newburyport?
Bingo. Yep. So Newburyport would be at the top end of Cape Ann, and then Gloucester would be at the more southern point, and I'm in between.
In between. So Gloucester is where the Perfect Storm boats went out of. Is that correct?
There you go.
All right. And then I had the fortunate experience of finding myself in Newburyport overnight for a business meeting at one time, probably 20 years ago. And what a beautiful town.
It's a nice town. Yeah.
I mean, unless something has changed in the last 20 years, I was blown away. I was like, this is a really nice place.
Yeah, no, it's the same town. There might be a Starbucks there now that wasn't there then, but yeah. Same town.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe one big chain store like Target or something has been put in. Right. Yeah. So how's the pandemic going on up there?
Massachusetts was in the crosshairs, and specifically Cape Ann, actually, one of the troubled areas last year, and then it resurged again a few months ago. But vaccination rates or acceptance rates, willingness to get vaccinated, has been pretty high. So it feels a lot better now.
So I'm in Atlanta, so this is the South, and you know, I think we're having collectively, I think the South is having a bit of a different experience with COVID. I'd say it was about February, and it was a nice, beautiful Saturday, maybe the first initial spring day, because it starts early down here. Mm-hmm. And I went outside, and it was literally like the entire city just said, "That's it, I give up." And they were all outside on one day. And like every park was full, every sidewalk had people walking. And so we've been sort of out of, I guess, where people are super concerned since about February. And they have an unbelievable vaccination machine going on down here. I mean, it's set up everywhere. It's at the airport. It's at the football stadium. I mean, it's just, you know, if you can't find a vaccine in Atlanta, you're not doing something right. Right.
Yeah. That's a good thing. I mean, you want to make it obviously as easy as possible.
Yeah. Yeah. So in your words, I mean, I have you down here as the global investment strategist for MFS, which sounds like a really cool and impressive job. So, I'm kind of, you know, proud to have you on my podcast. So thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So in your words, What is your role at MFS, or I guess in the movie Office Space, they famously said, so tell me, What is it you do around here?
I think the simplest way, at least how I think about my job and my responsibility. So we have investors all over the world. There's about 200 of them. It's my job, in a sense, to sit on top of all of that. Right. So to aggregate what our universe of investors are seeing, hearing, reading, and most importantly, thinking and allocating capital. So when you hear, you know, strategists from maybe popular sell side firms that you might see on TV or listen to in podcasts such as this, oftentimes they're sharing a view. It might be an economic view, a market view. It's probably a view that they comprise on their own or within their team. I'm the opposite. I'm not looking to do that. I don't have a model per se. I don't have a black box. Instead, I just take it at a much simpler level. And collectively, what are our investors doing, right? Where are we active? And I use that as a signal of sorts, if you will, to then provide a larger market view. So I'd say my role is comparable to other strategists, right? I'm effectively given a view. Where I'm different is mine's probably more fundamentally oriented and also longer term.
So for our listeners, fundamentally oriented generally means bottom up. Is that what you are referring to? Sort of. So you sit on top of all the portfolios that are managed at MFS, which could be anywhere in the world, which, And you understand what all of those portfolios are doing, the opinions and responsibilities and everything of the managers of each of those portfolios. And then from there, you can then kind of get a collective view of how MFS as a whole is positioned and what each fund is doing and how to use it in portfolios and all that.
Exactly. So I do two things. You know, I attend I don't want to say all, because there's too many. I attend as many research meetings as I possibly can. I attended two already this morning. But what's more important than what someone says is what they're doing.
Right.
So oftentimes, it's a waste of time asking someone what they think, a portfolio manager, what they think. All I have to do is look at their portfolio, and you'll know exactly what they think.
Right.
So what I do is I listen. Yeah. I read our research, but then I can just look and say, okay, across, let's say, fixed income portfolios, where maybe short duration. So that signals to me MFS's interest rate view. Or I can look across and say, well, we're underweight the most riskiest parts of the credit market. So that will give me or validate our fundamental view. And that's how I go about my role.
Okay, so you understand the strategies as a whole at MFS probably better than anybody else at MFS, I'm guessing maybe.
I hope so, but maybe.
Maybe outside of that. Yeah. Okay. All right. So here's my question then. So we'll just dive right into this, right? So this podcast is called Deconstructing Alpha, which. Mm-hmm. So some people might sound like a dessert or something, you know, it sounds like some sort of like fancy restaurant thing or something, but it's really trying to get to the bottom of how really brilliant portfolio managers can deliver added value in their clients. So let's just start scratching on that. Right. So is there a central theme you think maybe that runs through many of the portfolios, or at MFS, are they all managed completely, you know, in isolation?
The answer to that is actually yes to both. So every investor is allowed to build their own model. So the railroad analyst is going to build his or her model that he or she believes is most appropriate to analyzing railroad companies. And then an equity railroad analyst is going to have a slightly different point of view and perspective than a credit railroad, right? So even though they're looking at the same fundamentals, one's looking at the top of the capital structure, cares more about collateral. The other one cares less about collateral, but more about the income statement.
Right.
And then at the portfolio manager level, every portfolio manager, they're ultimately responsible for all buy and sell decisions. So each investor, each PM is idiosyncratic, if you will, in that regard. But to your question, there is a consistent theme, if you will. And I think that consistent theme, particularly in equity portfolios, is simply we tend to gravitate towards what I call free cash flow compounders. So companies with something maybe a little bit unique, a little bit different that allows them to raise price every couple of years or so. And so they're less dependent on the business cycle.
Right.
So we tend to be overweight those types of assets and tend to be underweight things that are a bit more commoditized.
Right. Okay. So individual security selection is very important to what you do.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so there's getting back to this top down and bottom up, it's very interesting how every time you turn on the TV or you listen to something that's really interesting about markets, we're all so captivated by all this macro magic, right? You know,
right.
And we could talk a little bit about that, but what I find when I talk to investment managers, particularly, you know, I try to only talk to successful ones, is that everything is really, you know, really one of the secrets that listeners might need to know if they're going to, you know, build portfolios and everything it's really bottom up, right? It's really, yep. It sounds like it's company by company, bottom up, and security selection really matters. Is that resonate with you guys?
It absolutely does. And I think you can even simplify it further. What is investing? It's one person swapping a large bucket of cash, it might be $100 or $100 million, for uses of that cash and cash flows in the future, right? So that's at its core what investing is. It's two parties, one swapping capital in return for promise of future cash flows, right?
Yeah.
And so I think as an industry, you're absolutely right. The market gets overly caught up in that macro magic and that macro data, which is all rear view looking. And ultimately, when you're funding a business, whether it's maybe your favorite restaurant down the street from your house that you're going to go partners in with the existing owner, or if you're buying a public equity, it's the same thing. You're funding a project. Now, ultimately, the economy or the macro, let's call it, has some influence on the number of people that are going to go in that restaurant, how much they're willing to pay. But ultimately, what matters is how good is the food? What's the ease of parking? What's the wine selection list? All those things, that's what matters. And so ultimately, you're right. It's security selection is so much more important than trying to anticipate, is GDP going to be X or Y?
Yeah. And you know, I remember you guys used to have an ad campaign about 5 years ago or so, and maybe you still do, but it was really centered around, you know, security selection matters. And it really resonated with me because that's always been my opinion, is that, you know, we're making investments, right? So you, like you said, you take money and you're buying a security, whatever that security is, with the idea that you're buying a good security, right?
Yeah.
That will pay you back in some way. And I think, like, it sounds like to me when I read and listen to things that are in the industry today, is that we've really gone very far from that, right? Like everybody wants to talk about indexing versus active. They want to talk about, you know, I'm overweight growth, or I'm underweight value, or I really, you know, think that international stocks are undervalued and they're going to rise. And all of that talk, it's like it seems to ignore to me the fact that at the end of the day, somebody's taking their hard-earned money and they're buying an investment. And the quality of that investment is really just the, you know, if it's a mutual fund, it's just the aggregate of the investments within that mutual fund. And so when you're building your portfolios, would you say that your mutual funds in general at MFS are like sort of benchmark hugging? You know, so are you trying to adhere to these sort of boxes that the world wants to put around mutual funds, or is it that each mutual fund is a strategy that you guys believe is a great investment strategy, and it's more security selection underneath a central theme?
More the latter than the former. Yeah, I think what's so important in any enterprise is having a clear, demonstrable value proposition to society, to the customer base, and being transparent how you go about that. And so if you're offering a small cap value strategy, you need to be buying small cap value stocks. You right. shouldn't be jamming emerging market micro caps in right. there, let's say, or high yield bonds. So I think in that kind of under that genre or that context, we're going to shop or invest in assets within that universe. But that said, if a benchmark is long an asset, we're not going to own it just because the benchmark.
Just because it's in the benchmark. Yeah. And you know, people forget the benchmarks are just indexes. They're just formulas that somebody came up with. You know, I always joke that why should MSCI decide how I invest, right? and they just, you know, EAFE is just a formula. Like somebody put it together, yeah. like, I don't know, 35 years ago, and we're all supposed to invest like that. And so,
yeah,
but,
yeah, I mean, so benchmarks are very linear forms of investing.
Yeah.
Right. It doesn't make it right or wrong. They're mathematically comprised based on what has happened.
Right.
Versus yeah. investing is anticipating what yeah. may happen. And so they have their place and they have value. But I think it's just an important distinction. One is yeah. based on what has happened and another is based on what they think will happen.
So there's a lot of mutual funds at MFS and we have you know, done our research and we think there's a lot of good mutual funds at MFS. Is there any particular mutual fund without making any recommendations here, but is there any particular mutual yeah. fund you'd like to talk about that you think is interesting right now?
I mean, not one off the top of my head. I mean, I manage a couple, so that's obviously my bias. So I'll do the opposite and stay away from that. I think largely, to me, you know, when you think about the last 12 months or the last, I guess now 14, 15 months, really since the lockdown, you've seen two tremendous things. One, obviously the huge re-rating of risky assets, right? So the 1 year performance of stocks off the bottom, that was the greatest four quarters of equity market return that we've seen in 90 years, right? So that's remarkable on its own. That's point one. Point two is within that, what was leading the way? It was cyclicals, right? So those companies, those stocks, those bonds, most levered to a reopening of an economy combined with trillions and trillions of dollars of stimulus. And what underperformed during that environment is the opposite, right? Companies that grow or earn cross cycle independent of what GDP is doing. So I think, you know, as an industry and as a society, we all suffer from penultimate preparedness, right? We're always preparing, or generals are always preparing to fight the war they last fought versus the next one.
Yeah.
And there's such a push, I don't know if it's an innate nature of humans to chase the tape, if yeah. you will, and emphasize what has happened. And I would just, rather than maybe isolate one area of growth or value or large yeah. or small, just for all investors to stop, take a breath.
Yeah.
Think about all the things that were weighing on the world pre-pandemic. Those things have actually worsened. And what will profits be, to your point, right? Because it's profits that drive stock prices.
Yeah. Yeah.
And let's look forward over the next 5 years. And I think what you see, the leadership you're seeing in the market now is not the leadership that will persist.
There's so much in what you just said there, and it's to me it's so topical and timely because, you know, I've sort of been wrestling with last year because I've been involved with the management of portfolios for 25 years. Last year was a really weird year, right? It was really it was very hard to predict. B, I don't, you know, and so your statement on investors really are, you know, investment managers are fighting the last war and investors are chasing the last years of return, right? That's just really what it is. Even when you look at a 10-year track record, it's heavily influenced by the last 12 months. And so, you know, everybody's always chasing performance. That's just the mode of the market, right? And yep. So what does it mean if you did well last year, right? With it last year being such an, weird is kind of like a general, it was just weird. So what does it mean if you were performed well last year? I know everybody's going to take their wins and be like, I performed well last year. I'm not taking that away from anybody. But what does it really mean about the future, particularly last year, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
I think it's so important to triangulate performance against value proposition, right? So every investment strategy, right? If it's a mid-cap growth fund, it has a stated objective philosophy and approach, right? So these managers seek these types of assets, or they have this sort of process. And whether a mutual fund has underperformed or outperformed or just been average, I think it's so important for the buyer to just triangulate that back to what the manager says he or she does. And so when I think about the last year, given what worked, if you just go back, it wasn't that long ago when the mindset was, will these businesses even survive? Right, cruise lines, airlines, movie theaters, rental car companies, anything levered to the end consumer. Right? That was literally the mindset. And then the central banks unlocked the credit markets, the lending spigot went wild, and then the narrative reversed. All investors wanted was the most highly levered, most at-risk enterprises, because the fat tail risk was removed, right? They weren't going to go to zero. That wasn't going to happen under this central bank's watch, is effectively what they communicated to the market. So I think managers that did materially well over the last 12 months did one of two things, right? They have a lower quality orientation where they it's a cyclical heavy portfolio, and that's completely fine, right, if that's how they advertise themselves. Or they have a high ability to maneuver the portfolio and sort of time these things. And neither of them are wrong. I'm just offering, I don't have, or we don't have that ability to anticipate those sort of tectonic step function shifts. Instead, we just try to own a financial asset versus renting it. Right. So I think there's this narrative of active investing and active trading are the same thing. They're entirely different. Active investing means I'm going to enter a long-term relationship with this enterprise. I want to understand, how do they do it? Can they keep doing it over a long period of time? And that's going to require engagement with the management team and the board of directors versus renting something because it's going to do well because the economy is going to reopen and there's trillions of dollars of stimulus, which is going to fade in 3 months.
Yeah. Let me put that into a little bit of my words. I think what you're saying is that there was, this is just my words. a lot of weird things happened last year, and it appeared to me that there was a lot of what I would call speculators that sort of entered the market. And my definition of a speculator is you're simply buying something because you're going to sell it to them at a higher price and you don't even really care what you're buying. Right. And an investor makes that the opposite of that, which is I analyze the investment. I know the data, I know the sales, I know the profit margins, I know the marketplace, I know the competitors, and I think I'm getting a reasonable value for this investment. And I think this investment's a going concern forever, and it's, going to be in a favorable market environment for the next 10 years or something like that. And it appears last year that the speculation sort of went rampant, right?
Yep.
And I think I've sort of likened it to 1999. Mm-hmm. Does it feel that way to you at all?
I think there's parallels. Every cycle is different. Every cycle is, there are no two cycles alike, so to speak, sort of like snowflakes. So I think it has its parallels to the 90s from a euphoric standpoint. So I think you're right about that. Where I think it's different is that in the 90s, interest rates were materially higher. 5, 6, 7, 8% real rates, most importantly, so rates after you subtract out inflation, were about 3%. Conversely, I think this looks more real rates. Conversely, real rates today are -1%.
Right.
Right. So I think it looks more like 1932, 1933, for two reasons. Right. So coming out of the Great Depression, you had the New Deal. Right. Yeah. So there's the cop. You had a washout in valuation like we had in March.
Yeah.
You had the New Deal like we had in April, and risky assets returned 80%, which is exactly what happened in 32. Now, the magnitude was bigger.
Yeah.
Stocks were up 120%, something like that. But that was the last time 90 years ago where you saw that type of return in the equity market.
Right.
And I think the thesis wasn't dissimilar. It was, we're going to stimulate the heck out of the economy. Yeah. and cyclicals re-rated. And what I think is important for investors to understand is that ultimately margins and profits drive stock prices. So when the stimulus faded, we were back in a recession again by, I think it was 36, 37, and markets had anticipated that before it ever happened. Now, I'm not suggesting we're on the precipice of that,
right?
But I think it's just so important for people to appreciate what central banks did because of the pandemic to save lives. So I'm not arguing they shouldn't, but
yeah,
when you take rates from positive to negative and you're discounting future cash flows with a negative rate, valuations go to infinity.
Right.
And that's to your point, exactly what happened.
There's no, and people, there's no way to really value anything. And
correct,
then, and that's what starts this euphoria. And
yep,
then it sort of takes on a mind of its own. And, because the market leads the economy, and I think investors often forget this, the market leads the economy, right?
Yeah.
And so then the economy becomes good, right? So it becomes, yeah, a self-fulfilling prophecy that if you raise asset prices, the economy will be better, but it feels artificial, right? And so the, prior to the pandemic and prior to this response that we experienced, the world seemed to be languishing in this sort of high profit margin, but slow growth,
yep,
environment,
yep,
with very low interest rates. And we felt stuck, right? Because,
right,
you couldn't lower interest rates to stimulate anything really much more. You didn't have a lot of growth, but you had fat profit margins, and then the world just seemed to be languishing. And then,
yeah,
COVID hit, and then it's just an explosion. So I it does feel temporary.
Yeah.
Right. Sooner or later, we might. But because asset prices have raised so much and people have generated so much wealth here, it does also feel like maybe there's a little bit of a new normal here. Is there a new normal, mm-hmm, here, or is it more?
So what you just hit on of the pre-pandemic decade,
mm-hmm,
is such an important point that is, I'm just amazed at how much it wasn't emphasized by the media, the marketplace. So to take what you said and put some numbers behind it, from 2010 to 2020, if you take the S&P 500, take all the companies in and add up their earnings, you can kind of treat the S&P like it's a company. So let's just pretend the S&P 500 is a company. In 2010, or just coming out of the global financial crisis, operating earnings or profits per share were about $50, give or take. For the next decade, they went from 50 to 150, right? So up threefold, and it's not a coincidence, stocks were up almost 300%, right? So margins higher, profits higher, stocks higher. It's, investing is that simple. What's fascinating in the juxtaposition, which you referenced, that gets ignored, that was the weakest economic growth cycle since the U.S. Civil War.
Yeah,
okay, now it was super long, but remarkably weak.
Yeah.
So profitability is derived from three things. Revenues, which breaks down into units, and price. So how many widgets do you sell at what price? How many computers, cars, mutual funds at what price? So those are the first two inputs. The third is cost. And so when you have that kind of low growth environment, revenue growth for the S&P 500 was about 2%. Now it normally averages 3 or 4 times GDP. So if GDP is normally let's say 4%, revenue growth would be 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, something like that. In the 2010 decade, GDP was below normal, revenue growth was below normal, but that profit expansion of 300% was all time. So how do those two things live together? And the simplest explanation, if you just kind of take a Sherlock Holmes methodology, remove all possibilities, the one left standing is the answer. It's monetary policy allowed companies to substitute what was otherwise poor revenue growth or weak operating cash flows with financialized cash flows, right? They levered their balance sheet to buy back stock. So every business cycle has an element or something that gets overbought, right? It was hardware, tech hardware in the 90s. It was houses in the 2000s. Where was it this time? It wasn't anything in the real economy. It was the financialization of balance sheets. Yeah. So then, to your point, enter the pandemic. Pandemic hits. What happens in February and March? A credit lockup. It should not be lost on people, but it was, that the credit crisis you saw in February and March, yes, it was the pandemic that started the fire, but the kindling was all-time leverage on corporate America's balance sheet going into the pandemic. And that's what created that chaos. So when the central banks came in and said, okay, this is a dire situation, we're going to allow companies to make it even worse, which is exactly what happened. Balance sheets got more levered over the last year. So sorry for the long answer, but back to your point, here we are now. What were the structural problems of the last decade, right? It was too much debt on corporate balance sheets. It was poor demographics, and it was technology. We think of technology as being economically accretive. It's not. It's deflationary.
Right.
So which of those three things have reversed? There's more debt, demographics are worse, and technology is growing and growing and growing. So to bring it all to your point, I have no idea what GDP will be over the next few years. I think it'll be low. I think we'll just revert back to where we were after the stimulus fades, after we're all done spending our free money like drunken sailors in restaurants and bars this summer. Then after that, you're back to where we were before. Yeah, and that's when I think, and the market has to reconcile with that.
Yeah, and what we're left with is very high asset prices and an entire generation of wealth dependent on those asset prices and probably overinvested and just, you're just kind of hanging there. So the constant that you've kind of said in the last, since 2010, like the constant to me has been central banks, right? And it's been, you know, internationally, they've been doing it longer. And so the gap for the growth, to fill the growth gap, central banks all over the world have just been printing money or whatever you want to call it, right? Keeping interest rates low, enabling the printing of money, QE, all the things they do, right? And it seems like anybody that's a strategist or building models or building portfolios should really now be saying, well, the Fed's sort of a permanent thing in my model. Anything before 2010 doesn't really count because now that was pre-Fed, right? You know, and now it's all Fed. And but the factors, as you said, the exact factors that I keep coming back to, which is you have a slow growth environment, and that slow growth environment is because of population growth, which is very slow in the first world. Because of technology, which is price destructive, because of globalization, right? And so the Fed, the central banks around the world are trying to fill that gap. So how does it end? I mean, so now we're 10 to 15 years into the central bank era, and interest rates are still pegged at zero all over the world. And now the new fear is inflation, right?
Yeah.
And he can't turn the TV on without hearing about inflation. So I'm not really sure how it ends, but let's talk a little bit about inflation. So inflation, you know, the Fed's saying transitory, other people are saying, no, we turn the corner here. This is the new deal. Yeah. How are you guys on inflation? What are your latest thoughts on that?
I think the Fed's right for all those reasons that you mentioned, right? So all those structural forces are deflationary or at the least disinflationary. And look, at the end of the day, inflation is a function of supply-demand imbalance. So despite the vast amount of money printing that began post-global financial crisis, the reason it didn't create inflation was because the supply of goods available was growing. It was growing because of technology. It was growing, ironically, because falling interest rates allows for zombie companies to exist, right? Yeah. Falling interest rates disintermediates the value proposition of investing, which is I'm going to take money from this company and put it in this company. The company that I took it from shouldn't be in business anymore because they're not good enough, right? So there's a natural selection process to capitalism and capital markets, and that natural selection process is bad companies die. That hasn't happened, right? You have to allow. So by taking rates to zero, central banks have usurped the natural selection process of markets, and we're allowing companies to continue to survive and produce goods that we don't need. All of that is disinflationary or deflationary. So here we are now, printed $25 trillion, right, globally, which is 1/7 of GDP, and we're going to spend it like crazy. Yeah. Right, in ballparks and at Disney World and everywhere else. And I get that. But that fades.
Yeah.
So ultimately, right now you're seeing higher prices in cars, in food, in lumber. So it feels like inflation. And I totally appreciate that. But if that is not accompanied by a commensurate change in income growth, it's going to serve as a tax.
Yeah, just so, you'll just end up with higher prices. And what it looks like in the workforce is people are exiting the workforce, right? So when we talk about demographics, one of the big things that's happened after COVID is the employment population ratio, which is like how much, what percentage of your population is going to work. And so that feels really weird to me. And so it is interesting because, you know, so inflation to me, I agree with everything you just said. It feels transitory because I don't know how you change the environment that we were in just 9 months ago, right? Nothing's changed. As you said, it kind of has all gotten worse. And so it looks like a supply shortage and a current explosion in demand. And it looks kind of transitory. And that might explain why interest rates on bonds, you know, sure, they've risen a point, but they were really low, right? So, you know, the market's up 80% and interest rates rose 1% and they were at all-time record lows. That feels extremely normal to me. In fact, that feels like the bond market's doing way better than I thought it would do, given the circumstances. But but maybe that's maybe it's the oversupply of money. And, you know, everybody seems to have a lot of money and the, you know, the demand for storage alongside of, you know, really a core belief that the real investors are, think that the inflation's transitory. Otherwise, the bond market would have been hammered, right?
Yeah, but both markets are telling you inflation's transitory. So as you mentioned, the yield curve is telling you that. And risk markets are telling you that. So if you just remember the old rule of 20 for equities, right? It's 20 minus inflation, that's your market multiple. The market multiple today of 23 times is implying two things. It's implying a 40% earnings growth this earnings season, which short-term consensus is usually right, and it seems directionally that's where we're headed. So let's assume that we're going to continue the path of tremendous earnings growth. And two, at 23 times, that's implying negative real yields, which is what we have right now. And so I do think it's transitory. The part that I think back to your earlier comment, is this a new normal, a new paradigm? Where I think there's a new normal is up until the last few years, important societal issues companies could ignore, right? If whether that was social inequality, labor inequality, unfair labor practices, how they source goods, where are they harmful to the environment, all those sorts of things. You always had NGOs that would try to change corporate behavior. But now, because of social media and technology and sort of a break it and move fast culture and transparency being so so good now, companies' behavior, they're going to be forced to change. And so where that is going to alter things is that if you used to dig a hole over here and now you're not able to dig up that hole there because it has environmental reasons. You're going to have to dig it over here somewhere else. It's going to cost more money. Who's going to pay for that? Either you, the company, will pay for that through lower margin, or right. the customer will pay for that through higher prices. So I think that's a new paradigm that has not existed.
That is a fascinating new little tangent for me to think about. So in my space, in my little part of the world here, in the asset management industry, you know, SRI and social responsible investing is really bubbled up. And you know, this might not sound right, but I feel like most businesses are pretty socially responsible already in this day and age, right? Like this post-COVID, it seems like a lot more social responsibility type environment all over the world. And so it's really not, you know, profits versus ideals or anything like that. I just think it's a global shift. And it does feel like companies as a whole are much more socially responsible, as of late. And that trend probably has legs, right?
Oh, I think it is and I used the word earlier, paradigm.
Yeah.
I think, if you way to box it, so you had the era of shareholder primacy, right? So kind of beginning with Milton Friedman that persisted for 40 years. And that's fading. And I think what's important is people confuse altruism with ESG or social response. It's not. It's two different things.
Right.
It's about sustainability. So if company X has been extracting economic rent from a stakeholder that it might not be able to extract that same level of rent going forward because maybe they have to pay more because of higher minimum wage, or maybe they've got to shrink their supply chain because there's a portion of it that's using slave labor and customers aren't going to buy that product if it's made using slave labor,
right.
Then that is going to be cost accretive.
Right.
So I think what's so important for investors to now consider is it's not about altruism or doing what's right. Is the business, is the cash flow sustainable?
Right.
Because they've got to make a change. It might be a big change. It might be a small change.
Yeah.
And how will that flow through the income statement? And I think that's a different dynamic.
It makes sense that going forward, a good investment is going to be a good investment with good cash flows. And to have good sustainable cash flows, you have to be a good business partner to the world, right?
Correct.
And the punishment, I think, is quicker and more severe and will be going forward. You just can't have these sort of zombie businesses that are not really doing anything that, you know, that makes the world a better place or actually they're making the world a worse place. Great thought. So we covered a lot, right? We are kind of butting. We're going to have to do another call, Rob, because this is fun. we're talking about all the things I love to talk about, and I don't know how we got here, but this has been a really, really great. I share a similar job to you. And a lot of similar opinions. You know, I think what we kind of covered here is that, the pre-pandemic environment really is probably going to be the post-pandemic environment. The central banks are a big player here and feels kind of permanent, and we're still not sure. Next time we'll cover how in the world do we get out of this? one of the points I wanted to kind of cover here, and we could maybe do it next time, or maybe final comments from you, is that it would, you know, so if we are reflating and interest rates do want to rise, you know, because I always say want to rise because the market depicts a lot of this stuff.
Yep.
It'd be really hard for them to do that without hurting the economy. And this is, I think, what you're probably hinting at with this, not really hinting at, but that this costs, you know, there's a cost to being more social. And that in itself also feels like it's a, you know, I don't think it's a huge drag on the economy, but it would sound like somebody has to pay a little gap. So So probably not the, you know, well, I don't know where I'm going with this. let's get, but we'll probably cut that out.
Well, but I think you're right though. I think it's inflationary to the economy because it's going to force companies to spend, but it's deflationary to margin and profits. And that's where it comes back to why ultimately you got a stock pick.
Yeah. And this is really like a great theme here that there is a lasting and permanent new thing in the industry. And it is the social impact of the businesses that you're investing in and what that does to their bottom line. It's not really an ideal thing. It's just like, we're still trying to make great investments, right?
That's it.
So we are butting up against my sort of hour. I try to end this. It's been fantastic talking with you. This has been such a surprise for me. And so I really appreciate you being on here. Is there anything final you want to leave investors with here or any comments you want to make? Because we did talk about a lot of stuff.
Yeah. No, I think it's it just always to come back to investing is simple, but really hard. And the metaphor or analogy I use, it's a lot like running. Running is simple. It's left foot, then right foot, then left foot, then right foot. But it's really hard, at least for non-runners like myself. And I think in an era or a world where information is so democratized, right, it's available to anybody with a cell phone or an internet hookup, your level of knowledge has grown dramatically. So we're drowning in information, but we're starved of knowledge. And so what good investing is I think discerning between what's noise, what's non-material data, maybe what a politician says or what a policy banker says, or even what a company prints from an earnings standpoint, and what matters, what's going to drive long-term cash flows. And because that's all investing is, whether it's in the public equity markets or private.
That is a perfect summary, because I think investors really do feel this overwhelming like flood of information and data, and you can get any piece of information you want. And at the same time, you could just push a button and buy whatever you want.
Yep.
But that doesn't mean you're going to be successful, right? So, all right. Well, thank you so much for playing, Rob.
Thank you.
This has been fantastic. I would love to have you back on, and we can talk about all the things that we didn't cover, because I'm sure that we could probably talk for a long time here. So
I think so.
I so appreciate you. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Jeremy, I thought that was going to be boring, but it was really interesting. I'm still trying to figure out how you are lucky enough to talk to such knowledgeable people.
You have such faith in me, Shannon. I'm sorry I make you stay on the call for the whole recording. But no, that was really like that. That was really cool. I got so much out of that. And I really felt like I was talking to somebody I'd known for a really long time. And to be honest, I've never met Rob before. So this was, I just think that was a really a fun call. Now, I don't know how this is getting out, because, you know, I mentioned it briefly to one of the people I talked to at MFS, and it rolled right up the chain at MFS, and they were like, we want to be on your podcast. And I was just blown away. So, I thought that was really interesting, and it was a really fun call. And I think Rob and I would have a lot more to talk about. So maybe we can do a follow-up.
Absolutely. Yeah, there were so many great things that you guys talked about. So let's talk a little bit more about the statement Rob said. Investment managers are fighting the last war and investors are chasing the last year's returns. I thought that statement was so on point.
It really is so on point, because I think every investment person should know this by now, is you have to invest for the future. You're not a time traveler. You have to go forward, right? You don't get to go backwards. You don't get to buy tech stocks today and somehow miraculously get the return that has already happened. You have to go forward. And I think people forget that. And I think that we're all kind of, you know, deep down inside, I think investment managers in particular, and all kinds of people are, you know, they worry about things they got right and things they got wrong. And the things they got right, we often don't take credit for. And the things we got wrong, we overanalyze. And so that probably trickles down into investment processes. And you know, like we just, you say, oh, well, I know we have to go forward, but man, we got that wrong 2 years ago and we make sure we don't want to do that again. So I think there's a lot of looking backwards from the investment management standpoint. And there's definitely a huge problem with investors chasing past performance, right? I mean, this has been going on my entire career. You hit the nail on the head. Like, this is an issue. And it's not just past performance. It's really, I mean, it's pretty obvious what's performing well. But then when you have like a really good year, it unseats everybody. Everybody gets uncomfortable and everybody says, well, that's it. I got to get in now.
Right.
And then the 1 year number, keep in mind, you know, with this mathematical phenomenon, the one year return is in the 3 year return is in the 5 year return and the 10 year return. So maybe the 10 year return is just really one good year, and which wouldn't sound predictive. So anyway, great point. That was probably one of my biggest points that I would want to summarize is the recency effect and fighting the last war.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought that was super interesting. Another topic I found interesting was when Rob was talking about the fat tail risk being removed when it comes to airline, you know, industries and cruise lines and entertainment. Yeah. And I didn't think anything about that until he started talking about that. And it makes total sense.
Yeah. So let's just cover what I think he's referencing in terms of fat tail risk. So there's normal risks, right? There's lots of different kind of risks, but generally when you're speaking of fat tail risk, you're speaking of like risks of a catastrophic failure, right? Which would be in these cases with cruise lines and airlines and entertainment industries would have been bankruptcy, right? And so I think the initial response to the COVID shutdowns was these industries are dead. And so their stocks really got annihilated. And then when the Fed stepped in and says, no, we'll save it again. So we'll save the economy and the markets, comma, again. And when the Fed stepped in, it removed that tail risk because it made investors feel like, well, cruise lines look like they're priced to go out of business, but if the Fed's going to help them, well, we got to get those prices back to some normalcy. And right. So the biggest initial bounce was in the riskiest, most dangerous stuff.
Absolutely. Something I wanted to highlight on is that security selection is very important.
Yeah, it's sort of the theme of this podcast, right? Like, I think the world is, I think it's really fun to be a macro predictor and try to anticipate what markets and when things are going to move and use ETFs or index funds to try to target specific investments that thematically feel like they're going to be good, right? But that's not investing. A lot of that is speculation. And what real investing is breaking down the components in your portfolio one by one and having a thesis of why you own each security. And I find that, you know, in the forces of active versus passive and macro versus bottom up, many of the best investment managers are bottom up fundamental security selectors.
Interesting. So, Jeremy, what are your thoughts about Rob's observation of businesses moving towards the importance of social factors in the business models?
Yeah, that's a really great point too. That one surprised me. I wasn't expecting that. And that theme has come up in a couple of my calls. And so in these podcasts, it's a couple of times the investment managers have said, you know, a really big factor here, sort of what used to be a small factor is now becoming these social concerns. And really it, you know, I think, I think Rob referred to it as shareholder primacy. And what he meant by that is, you know, a lot of the direction of managing a business has been on the bottom line, right? Which is, it doesn't matter what we do. We're just making profits. And if we make profits, then our shareholders should be happy because the shareholders, in theory, the stock will go up. And that's been the direction, you know, for a long time of business. And it doesn't have to be the opposite side of that, but coinciding with that is the idea that, well, you know, some businesses are just simply, you know, maybe better businesses than others, not better in terms of their, you know, social impacts, but just better business models. And then some businesses might have a better social impact. And then you can run your business, you know, with considering maybe not 100% of the profits as being the important component. And that's come up a couple of times in my calls. And I guess now today it's, you know, sort of the social aspect. And what Rob put was, you know, interestingly, that somebody has to pay for it. So it's either that the company is going to pay more money to be more socially responsible, either within their company or with their footprint, or the consumer is going to have to pay more money. And that there's a third piece of that, which is there's just more money floating around if that's going on. So in theory, a little bit less accretive to the bottom line, less earnings, maybe a little bit less earnings, but it's all about sustainability, not just sustainability for social issues, but sustainability for the business. Because in theory, if you're not a good business, you might not stay in business as long as a good business. So I thought that was a really good point.
Yeah, it's definitely something that businesses are keeping more in their forefront.
Yeah.
So to wrap up our time, I wanted to discuss one final part of the conversation with Rob that was very timely. It seemed like you both had the same view on what is currently happening in the capital markets. You talk about how the world operated a certain way up until COVID, but now it seems out of control. So do you think this is the new normal, or was the old normal the more relevant foundation? What do you think?
Yeah, that really came out true in this call. So like two things that really stuck with me is that, you know, I think the investment community right now is wrestling with the idea that, well, for the last 10 years, the world has operated in a certain manner, and it's been in this low interest rate, low inflation, slow growth environment. It's been the slowest recovery of all time. But at the same time, asset prices have crept up a lot. And so it's been good to be an investor, but like the actual in real life recovery has not been significant. And that there's been these standard reasons for that, right? Which is high debt levels, demographics, globalization, and technology all being price destructive. And so that's kept a lid on growth. And so are those factors still in play? Are they getting worse? Are they going away? Is a relevant question because they still seem like the underpinnings of controlled slow growth and low inflation and low interest rates. So those factors still seem to be there. But at the same time, we're having this burst in the economy and short supply of goods, you know, buyers outstripping suppliers.
Right.
And it's, you know, it just, I think the question is do we go back to the old way, or is the new norm just explosive growth? And whenever I'm faced with a question like that, I revert to my old saying, the truth is somewhere in the middle. So maybe the new sustainable level is somewhere in the middle of explosive growth and short supplies of goods and services, and the old world of slow and low. So the answer is probably somewhere in the middle.
I absolutely agree, Jeremy. Well, Jeremy, I think these interviews just keep getting more and more interesting. I can't wait to hear who you are interviewing next.
I know. I'm looking forward to it. We've got a great guest coming up for the next podcast. We're going to return to Matthew's Asian-focused investing, which is always one of my favorite topics. So I'm looking forward to that. And I appreciate everybody being on the call and sticking through the grand finale here. And I really enjoyed that call. I just really had a great time talking to Rob. What a great guy. Works for who I think is a really solid firm. I felt a good kinship with him. And so hopefully you guys got a lot out of that interview. I had a great time. So Shannon, thank you for participating.
Absolutely. Until next time.
This podcast is for informational purposes only. The information does not constitute advice or a recommendation of any specific investment, mutual fund, or mutual fund company. Before making any investment, you should carefully seek independent legal, tax, and regulatory advice. In particular, you should seek the advice of a licensed financial advisor regarding the suitability of the investment product, taking into account your specific investment objectives, financial situation, any particular needs, and your ability to assume the risk and fees involved before investing. This podcast and presentation are for informational purposes only. Frontier assumes no liability for any action taken in response to listening to this podcast. Frontier Asset Management is not affiliated with any specific fund company. The views and opinions expressed by each speaker are their own as of the date of the recording. Any such views are subject to change at any time based upon market and other conditions, and Frontier disclaims any responsibility to update such views.